Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Elise Thatcher.
That not-so-fresh aspen smell is coming from high-end condos.
The Aspen Power Plant is a nonprofit, but it's not a charity.
Congressional races get a shakeup.
And surprise medical bills are a top health insurance complaint in Colorado.
That's coming up on Mountain Edition.
The city of Aspen issued a cease and desist order yesterday at the residences at the Little Nell for contaminating the town's stormwater system with sewage. The government is warning people to keep themselves and their pets away from water in certain parks.
After several complaints about a strong stench wafting up through stormwater drains around town, city officials discovered there were high levels of E. coli and fecal coliform in the system. And after conversations with the city's engineering department, the residences at Little Nell recognized the problem and earlier this week shut down the sump pump, which was draining into the storm sewer. As a health precaution, the city has limited public access to the water features of Jenny Adair Wetlands and the western half of Rio Grande Park to prevent exposure to the bacteria. Both areas are located off of North Mill Street and feed into the Roaring Fork River. The city is advising that park users and their pets refrain from contact with the water. In addition, river users should take normal precautions not to ingest water or expose open wounds. Another controversial development proposal is being considered for the El Jebel area. Eagle County Commissioners reviewed the Fields proposal Tuesday night.
The more than four-hour meeting was reminiscent of public hearings about the tree farm proposal last fall, when scores of area residents criticized that development. Tom O'Keefe is one of the many neighbors who raised concerns about the number of units proposed in the Fields project. More than 100 homes and duplexes could be approved.
I don't think the high-density thing is really what we want in this valley. There is a need for housing. I'm not denying it. But these mega developments certainly is not the way to go.
The developer of the Fields has said a lower density would mean increasing the price of homes higher than the targeted $500,000. County commissioners will take up the Fields proposal again at a later date once there's more information about CDOT's take on the project and other details.
Republican Congressman Scott Tipton wants to introduce legislation that would exchange leases on the Thompson Divide for new drilling rights near Paonia and Rangeley. The measure is nearly identical to a proposal by the oil and gas industry last year.
Garfield County commissioners considered a draft of the bill on Wednesday as part of a courtesy call by Tipton's staff. Tom Jankowski and the other two commissioners praised the swap approach.
This takes care of a situation for us in Garfield County.
Mm-hmm.
So my position would be to ask you to move forward with this and see if we can't get it done.
But the same proposal prompted strong reactions last year by officials in the Roaring Fork Valley and Delta County. They said it wasn't fair to move possible oil and gas drilling out of the Thompson Divide and into some other community. The majority of public comments during Wednesday's meeting echoed those concerns. A man is calling Roaring Fork Valley residents claiming to be a Pitkin County sheriff and then asking for money. Aspen Public Radio's Barbara Platts reports.
The calls are coming from someone identifying himself as Lieutenant David Williams from the, quote, Warrants and Records Department. The suspect has been calling residents and telling them that there is a warrant out for their arrest. He then says the only way to prevent getting arrested is by electronically sending money to an account. But there is not a warrants department or lieutenants at the Pitkin County Sheriff's Office. Deputy Adam Kreider says law enforcement does not accept payments in exchange for dropping an arrest warrant.
We're not going to take money over the phone. It's going to be dealt with in our office in person or, you know, the jail or the court.
The suspect is reported to have a southern accent and calling from the number 970-238-0667. Law enforcement agents advise against giving any personal account information or paying money. Barbara Platts, Aspen Public Radio News.
The Aspen Ute Foundation was created to connect Native Americans to their cultural and spiritual heritage in the Roaring Fork Valley. Earlier this month, the foundation hosted its annual powwow in downtown Aspen.
The event is meant to keep traditions within the Native community alive and spread awareness about the valley's original inhabitants.
They have returned to these lands where my people roamed,
to make my presence known, and also to bring about presentations such as the dance and lectures to remind the people that there were people here before them, and that we were noble and proud people, and we are still in control of our traditions and cultural values, and we will display them, and we do it with our own magic.
Ute Indians were removed from the Roaring Fork Valley in the late 1800s after the Battle of Milk Creek. The government viewed the clash as a breach of a peace agreement. Roland McCook's ancestors were among those relocated to Utah. He was raised on a reservation there, learning the traditions, languages, and values of the Nooch, the name Ute Indians have for themselves. He served as a leader of the tribe and consulted on behalf of Native Americans for the Bureau of Land Management and the Smithsonian Institute. He now leads the Aspen Ute Foundation, the organization that puts on a yearly powwow in downtown Aspen, inviting members of all Native tribes to gather, dance, and share their heritage with current residents of the valley.
Greetings. I'm very happy to be here today. We come from the Hopi Nation, and we're very grateful for our singers. Let's put our hands together for the singers, the phenomenal singing. I want to recognize them because long, long ago, the late 1800s, early 1900s, this was an illegal thing for us to do, to sing and to dance. And so for our young men to be carrying this tradition on, I feel very proud to be dancing to these young men here today. I want to thank them.
A Nuke Bald Eagle of the Lakota Nation came to Aspen for the powwow this month. He's a descendant of Crazy Horse and, like his father, has had a career playing an Indian in motion pictures. He sees the powwow circuit as a way to pass traditions through generations.
Today, we do believe and I do see more pride into the youth and to the culture and to the singing and to the dancing more so.
Anu came to Aspen days ahead of the powwow to work on his regalia, the full costumes worn during the dancing performances.
A breastplate.
A long time ago with our ancestors, they used it for battle.
He stayed with Deanne Vitrak Kessler, who launched the Aspen Ute Foundation in 2005. Beyond hosting the annual powwow, the foundation serves as a year-round support group for Native Americans in the valley.
For the ones who want to come out of the reservation and find work, it gives some support for that. For example, this winter, we have a young teenage Lakota who wanted to get out of the reservation and come and study at the high school here in Aspen. And so we sponsor him.
The foundation also serves as a reminder of the atrocities two centuries ago.
For the white community, they have to take responsibility and be more knowledgeable about what's going on there, because they are a big part of it, and they are somehow responsible to what an American Indian is nowadays.
Though his tribe was cast away from the Roaring Fork Valley, Ute leader Roland McCook says the connection to this region is what defines his people.
All of the Rocky Mountains consider it as the Native American people's Walmart, where they get their food, clothing, medicine, and everything they need to sustain themselves. Our goal is to educate and to keep the Native Americans out front and not be forgotten, because we have not gone away.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Supporters of the Aspen Power Plant say the hybrid work and entertainment space serves a vital need for young professionals in the valley. Detractors remain concerned about having private businesses making money in a city-owned building.
Well, thank you guys all so much for coming out. If you guys have any questions.
There are two main gripes with the City Council's selected hybrid space. The first is from neighbors who say The Aspen Brewery-run food and beverage component will mean late, loud nights that will change the character of the neighborhood and devalue their property. In a community meeting last week meant to clear up misconceptions about the plans, Aspen Power Plant Director David Cook explained there are very clear closing hours for the space, an elimination of the parking lot, so a reduction in traffic to the neighborhood streets, and noise levels will be carefully controlled and measured.
We'll actually bring a sound engineer out, bring the decibel levels up to what is in the city ordinance. And so we'll turn the music up to that decibel level and then go do sound studies at every single touch point.
The second gripe has to do with the business model of the Aspen Power Plant.
So the Aspen Power Plant is going to be a 501c3. I'm assuming you're in that process?
No, it's not a 501c3, it's a nonprofit corporation.
Okay. That's 501c3. Then you can't call yourself a nonprofit if you're not a 501c3.
I'm not a tax lawyer, but that's what I understand.
That's interesting.
This spring, Cook, his Aspen 82 business partner, Spencer McKnight, and Aspen Brewing Company owner Duncan Klaus registered Aspen Power Plant as a nonprofit with the state of Colorado and dissolved their former LLC of the same name. The nonprofit is centered on what's called the generator portion of the Aspen Power Plant, meant to offer subsidized workspace for entrepreneurs. At this stage, all the nonprofit status really means is that the public can't receive any dividends of the profits made at the Aspen Power Plant. But because they've not registered as a 501c3, and because they're not soliciting or accepting donations, the Aspen Power Plant doesn't have any regulations on profit margins, and its finances are not public documents. David Hoogie, the executive director of the Buddy Program, a nonprofit in Aspen, questioned the directors about the balance of maintaining a public good while running the for-profit businesses that will contract with the nonprofit Aspen Power Plant.
So you could, in effect, pay all the money out to the for-profits and have nothing left over for the community. What's the regulatory body? How is that balance maintained for the benefit of the public?
After the meeting, Cook said his team will work to build in financial accountability for the nonprofit. Learning how to meditate can be difficult, and developing something called mindfulness can be just as tricky. Now, a Carbondale couple aim to make those activities a little easier to achieve.
Let the bell be an invitation. An invitation for your awareness.
That's Carbondale resident John Bruna. He's seen and experienced a lot. He's been homeless, he's been a corporate manager, and he's been a Buddhist monk, among many other things. Now Bruna and his wife, Laura Bartels, are creating an online community for people interested in mindfulness.
There's no agreed-upon definition of mindfulness, but one version of it is the ability to bear in mind who you are and what your values are.
Bruna and Bartels are based at their Way of Compassion Dharma Center in Carbondale. This newer project is called the Mindful Life Program, with daily teachings and other resources posted online for paying subscribers. Again, John Bruna.
The basic research right now says that, on average, mostly in the U.S., our mind is wandering about half the time that we're awake.
Bruna and Bartels have taught mindfulness courses for a while, usually traveling outside the Roaring Fork Valley to help participants make better choices, avoid bad habits, and generally stick to what students find important in life. Bartels, who's made a name for herself as a straw bale construction expert, says she and Bruna noticed their courses didn't seem to be enough.
We also wanted to be able to support people on a daily basis, because when you have daily support and you feel connected to a community, that's where you really can change habits.
That can be especially true for folks in addiction recovery. A woman we'll call Erin is a member of the Mindful Life program and says it's been helping her in the early stages of putting her life back together. She heard about the project and daily emails from Bruna.
I use it all the time. The first time I went on, I watched like all the videos that him and Laura did. And when I wake up, that's the first thing I read in the morning is the emails. So yeah, I use it a lot.
Part of the vision is always to make this accessible to people.
Again, founder John Bruna. He points out that the people who usually have time for mindfulness courses have a fair amount of disposable income, too.
We really wanted to take it out of the domain of just a wealthy, educated, you know, upper middle class.
He and Bartels are up against a plethora of meditation and mindfulness phone apps. So far, they have more than 200 online subscribers and hope to sign up tens of thousands in the coming years.
This past weekend, Buttermilk served as the site of the annual postseason tradition, the Canine Uphill. It's an uphill race for dogs and their owners. But this year, there was a new addition.
The dog sledding operation Kriblunik took over the race that benefits Friends of the Aspen Animal Shelter. Aspen Public Radio's Barbara Platts was there and brings us this report.
5 minutes out, 5 minutes out. Start, Canine Uphill.
Pooches big and small eagerly followed their owners to the base of the mountain Saturday morning to participate in the dog days of post-ski season. The third chairlift tower was designated as the starting line for the anxious pups, some of which were up for adoption at the Aspen Animal Shelter. This is the 21st year the Canine Uphill has taken place, but the first year it was coordinated by Gina and Danny Phillips, the new owners of Kriblunik. They bought the race from Eric Scarvin of Sundog Athletics in February. They did so at the advice of Seth Saxon, the director of the Aspen Animal Shelter.
I called and said, hey, I think this would be a great move. I think it would be good PR for you to interact with the community and be out there and let them meet some of your sled dogs, meet your mushers, and learn about Kriblunik. And I think it will pay off for itself a millionfold just in good community relations.
Danny Phillips says the race seemed like the perfect fit for them.
It can be 100 dogs and their people, and the dogs are going crazy. There's all these different types of dogs and all these different bloodlines of different dogs, but it seems like they all kind of come to be the same, and they all want to look up that mountain, and they're all excited. It's like the sled dogs, where there's 100 of them taking off all at one time.
Besides being a fun day for canines and their humans, the event also helps to get dogs adopted. Saxon says two dogs found new homes Saturday.
Hands down, the greatest benefit, I think, finding a dog a home. Fantastic, spectacular.
Local Trinity Terry, his wife, and son adopted a 2-year-old Jelly Bean from the shelter the morning of the uphill and then took her up Buttermilk.
We signed the papers. It was kind of just like the icing on the cake and a little celebration. We had fun.
Now that the uphill is in the hands of Gina and Danny, they are looking forward to growing it in the coming years so it becomes one of the main fundraising events for Friends of the Aspen Animal Shelter. The nonprofit assists, promotes, and provides for the welfare, care, and health of animals.
I'm really excited for next year and to have more time to plan it, and I think we just really want to make it a huge event because it's such a cool cause, and I'd like to make it one of their top fundraisers.
Friends of the Aspen Animal Shelter is responsible for neutering and spaying Kriblunik sled dogs, so the event helps benefit both parties. Barbara Platts, Aspen Public Radio News.
You are listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Allison Bektesh. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
The plans for a new hotel at the bottom of Aspen Mountain will get their first public review this summer. Developers of the Gorsuch House hope to build just over 60,000 square feet and put nearly all of their required affordable housing off-site. Carolyn Sakuraisen reports.
The land use application for the project was deemed complete by the City of Aspen 2 weeks ago. Jim DeFrancia is one of the developers behind the project. He met with city staff yesterday and was told public hearings will likely begin in July. DeFrancia says only one affordable housing unit would be on the property for either senior management or an on-site manager. Other employees would live in a location not yet determined. DeFrancia says they are looking at a few options.
We're required to satisfy 37 full-time employee equivalents. That translates into about 15,000 square feet of affordable housing.
The Gorsuch House would be 49 feet at its tallest point and would reach up to 4 stories. It would be situated next to the Shadow Mountain chairlift on the west side of Ajax. The new lift would be moved slightly to the west and be sandwiched between the Gorsuch House and another lodge yet to be built. Carolyn Sakuraisen, Aspen Public Radio News.
Buying and using health insurance can be time-consuming and complicated. A recent review of complaints found that a top issue is which doctors a patient can see.
Adam Fox is with the Colorado Consumer Health Initiative in Denver. The nonprofit has been keeping an eye on insurance networks across the state, and Fox and his colleagues took a look at data from 2012 through 2015. They noticed this trend with complaints.
Overwhelmingly, the largest category really has to do with out-of-network bills and surprise medical bills that consumers are encountering because they're unknowingly treated by an out-of-network provider. This happens in a couple of ways. A health insurer won't have necessarily the same contracts with a hospital that it may have with some of the providers that are working within that hospital. And there's not really a system to verify that all of the providers in a hospital are within the same insurance networks. And so what happens is you'll get somebody who goes to the hospital potentially for a routine surgery or emergency, and they're treated by a provider who happens to be out of network, even though they're at an in-network facility. And what happens then is the out-of-network provider will bill them separately because they don't have a relationship with that insurer, and that's called balance billing, or what is more commonly termed as surprise medical bills. Or the other issue is that consumers are looking at their provider directories of their insurance plan. They may see a provider listed on that provider network and may not know that provider has been dropped from that network, because it's a bit of a challenge for insurers to keep those provider directories 100% up to date.
Are you seeing that they're clustered in certain areas?
What we saw as far as the complaints that we requested from the Division of Insurance is they're spread relatively equally throughout the state. A few other things that consumers expressed a lot in their complaints was claims being denied, potentially wrongfully. And so that presents a lot of challenges for the consumer because they have to go through an appeals process with their insurance carrier to get access to the care that they need. The other thing that was also expressed was just kind of broad concerns about not having access to the providers that they need, or what's known as network adequacy. And really, a lot of those complaints seem to center around not having a nearby provider that they could see easily. And in some cases, that was particular to not being able to see a specialist provider. And in some cases, that was also referred to kind of the inaccuracy that can occur in some provider directories.
I see. Like, the specialist actually may be there in the network, but someone can't tell.
What's more often is consumers will see a provider listed as in-network and will try to access that provider, only to be surprised, potentially sometimes when they're already at that provider's office, that that provider is no longer in-network. Because the contracts between an insurance carrier and a provider are largely at will, so the provider can leave at any time, or the insurance carrier could largely drop them at any time. Some of our recommendations really center on as much consumer notification as possible. How can consumers be better notified when they may be treated by an out-of-network provider, and also be notified that they have potentially some legal protections under Colorado law from that surprise medical bill? Plans that are regulated by the Division of Insurance have some protections in that they can only be charged the in-network rate if they are unknowingly treated by an out-of-network provider.
Adam Fox is Director of Strategic Engagement at the Colorado Consumer Health Initiative in Denver. The Colorado Division of Insurance released a clarification on the issue this week, saying returning patients have to be notified within 30 days if a doctor is no longer covered by an insurance carrier. The agency aims to address hospital surprise billing later this year.
Ballots for this spring's election for two board seats at the Aspen Valley Hospital are expected to show up in mailboxes this week. Carolyn Zachariasen has the details.
It's the first contested race of the board of directors at the hospital in 6 years. AVH canceled two previous ones because no one applied, except for the incumbents. Amy Trubiroha is the hospital's election official. She says just over 11,000 ballots were dropped in the mail Tuesday. She expects more turnout this year than in 2010, when just under 5,000 people voted for three candidates.
With seven people running for two spots, anything can happen. I mean, even with the Basalt election, there's a lot more interest in what's happening in our community than there probably was 6 years ago.
Chupi Roja is hoping at least 7,000 people will vote in the election. Ballots must be returned to AVH's administration office by 7 p.m. on May 3rd. They can be mailed or dropped off in person. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
The Aspen Art Museum is trying to create an outlet for high schoolers to keep the arts alive for teens throughout the valley. Aspen Public Radio arts and culture reporter Patrick Fort tells the story of how students are curating their own art show.
During recent weeks, some high school students were choosing art for their show called Generation Now. It features work created by students from Aspen to Rifle. There's sculpture, painting, drawing, and one piece in particular is a collection of vinyl records that have been melted and formed into something that looks like a flower. All of the work was curated by students, and all of the work was made by students. It's a program by the Aspen Art Museum called Young Curators of the Roaring Fork. Heidi Zuckerman, the museum's CEO, started the program 10 years ago when she felt like people couldn't speak openly about how they felt, especially young people.
A lot of people communicate on kind of a superficial level, and it could be because of the abundance of technology, but what I'm interested in a broad way, and specifically with the program, is working with people to define their language to be really specific.
So in an effort to get students to talk authentically about art, she founded the program. Here's what happens. First, student curators are selected from schools throughout the valley. They don't even have to be art students necessarily. They get together to judge art submitted by local school artists.
There's definitely some pieces where it's pretty split down the middle of this half of the room doesn't like it and the other half does.
Sari Bear is a junior at Aspen High School.
We have to figure out how to pick some of the pieces that everyone likes and pick the pieces that you don't like, and learning how to live with that decision. And you have to figure out how to accept like what your peers' ideas are.
So they narrowed down the dozens of pieces they received to work by 14 artists. It was a collaborative process that forced students to dive deeper into how they feel about specific works. It wasn't just about if they liked it or not. They had to expand more on the feelings they had about each piece.
Well, what do you see? And what do you think? And what do you value? And how do you defend it?
Zuckerman says she's trying to help students think openly and honestly without doing it offensively. The results of the curation process are on display at the museum. Tish McPhee teaches art classes at Glenwood Springs and Bridges High Schools. She says she's seen her students change and benefit from the program.
They grow because they have to put their work out there, which is so, so personal, and ask to be accepted into a show. And I know that's really, really hard for them to do, to have someone else judge whether their work is fits in, or and they feel like then it's, do these people like it?
In the 10 years it's been going on, Zuckerman says she's seen the program evolve from having just artists to being a more diverse crowd.
The kids in the program don't necessarily make art themselves. In fact, very few of them do now. They're more interested in visual culture, and they're more interested in that kind of criticality.
Sari Bear is enjoying her second year of participating in the program because of how she's learned to collaborate with other students.
I've met so many people that I would have never met that I get to work with in this environment. And so it's really interesting to see their perspectives and listen to them and meet them.
The show is on display through next weekend. Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Elise Thatcher. To hear this show again or download a Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.